Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Anarcho-Capitalism. And today is August 25th, 2012. Today is special because it's, I think, Paul Fest is today. My Facebook friends know what they're talking about. And I, of course, am safely ensconced in Nashville, Tennessee, just in case the FBI tries something. They won't be able to take out the whole Liberty Movement with one fell swoop. So we got a few people logged in. If you guys want to fire off a question, I'll start pontificating. At this point, whatever pops into your head, go ahead and type it because it's better than dead air. I mean, I can try to come up with something just to talk about, but it would help if you get too logged in and typed in a question. Okay. Thank you, Gordon. And obviously, while I'm answering, if you think of something else, go ahead and post it. So Gordon Clark says, why do civilizations continue to make the same mistake when it comes to government? There must be some serious scholarship on this subject. That's a great question, and that sort of ties in, which is maybe why you asked it, with the, I guess it was the last slide that I covered in week four. So week four, to refresh people's memories, we covered the general theme of that lecture was common objections. And so a lot of them, I think, you know, in my opinion, just you knock them out of the park. You know, what about a neighboring state that tries to take over? To me, that's the least of the anarcho-capitalist society's worries, that, you know, organizing a military defense, if you had everything else set up in place, private property framework, legal system, and so on, the provision of military defense, in my mind, nothing. But what is interesting, the thing that does give me a little bit of pause, is this issue of, okay, well, if your approach makes so much more sense, I mean, because we really do think, and by we, I mean anarcho-capitalists in the Rothbardian tradition, it's not like, oh, it'd be 10% better if we had this system. I mean, it would be a world largely without police brutality, without poverty in any sense of the word. The educational system would be so much better. Healthcare would be so much better. I mean, it's hard to even imagine the standard of living of a society that had our level of technology and so on, and the one thing that we changed is the vast majority of people really took property rights seriously, and so they couldn't support a state in any sense that we use the term today. I mean, I think even Rothbardians don't quite appreciate just how incredibly wealthy and better that society would be on any dimension you want to choose. So given that that's our view, it does seem kind of odd, and this goes back to Gordon's question, why are we not doing that? You know, why hasn't – you'd think it would just have to happen once, and then everybody would see how phenomenal it was, and everybody would copy it. And – I'm trying to just organize my thoughts here because it's, on the one hand, I mean, you see that a lot. I think it's partly just human nature. And there is an interaction that it's a special type of thing that in many fields, the incentive structure and the institutional framework is such that error gets weeded out and merit or achievement, excellence rises to the top, right? So like in sports or something, some guy the other day had just watched a soccer game for the first time, meaning like a full from start to finish soccer game, and he was, you know, on Facebook going off on how silly it was, and, oh, if I were coaching, I would do this, this, and this, and clearly these players don't shoot very well, and he's critiquing the whole thing. And so my response was, you know, I had played soccer growing up and everything, and so I, first of all, just thought the guy was wrong in terms of my own understanding of the game and so on, but I made an institutional argument saying, if it were that simple, like just tweaking a few things that are obvious to you after watching your first game in your life, don't you think some coach on planet Earth would have had the same idea and done those things and then just steamroller over everybody? So the fact that not a single coach is implementing all these things that are patently obvious to you after watching your first game, that should be a strong hint to you that maybe there's something you're not seeing, and all these coaches who have dedicated their careers to soccer aren't stupid for something that you, as a completely novice onlooker, can recognize after watching one game, right? Whereas a statist, you would think, could say the same thing to us, the anarchists, and say, oh, so you're just saying we just got rid of the government, all of a sudden everybody would be richer, there'd be no more business cycles, there'd be no more police brutality, you think crime would go down, and you think you'd be safer from foreign invasion, and you think you'd explore space better, you'd have faster computers, better healthcare, blah, blah, blah. And they could say, if that's so obvious, then how come no one's tried it yet? How come we look back in history and all we see are states being formed, and whenever there is a temporary fall of a state, those people quickly put in a new state, don't they, right? So even in cases where you do have anarchy in some loose sense of the term, if you define it not as an ideological embrace of statelessness, but just because of an earthquake or a civil war or whatever, the government falls, how come we expect, studying history, that if we look at these same people 10 years from now, they're probably going to have a government again? It's not that they're going to, in the absence of the old government, now anarcho-capitalist wonder springs up, and then these people say, holy cow, this is awesome. So that's a great question, and I think it has to do with the fact that coercion is involved, and it's not a free system, and that when you think of the areas where merit does rise to the top, it's areas where there are clearly defined rules and there's not cheating involved and violence. Whereas you wouldn't say, like if somebody said, you know, I'm surprised that when it comes to the political process, how come the two major parties keep putting up these dolts that even the ideological people can't get excited about? You know, so it's not even that let's say I'm an anarcho-capitalist Rothbardian. Obviously, I don't like some far-left environmentalist person who wants to raise taxes to 100% or to 90% on the top income earners and who wants to really break the backs of all the major Wall Street investment banks and who wants to have national health care and stuff like that. Obviously, as a Rothbardian, I wouldn't support that agenda, but yet it's interesting to me that the Democratic Party gets votes from far leftists who that is what they want, even though the candidates they put up are virtually indistinguishable from the candidates the Republicans put up. Right? So Barack Obama had great rhetoric, and a lot of leftists, I'm sure, voted for him thinking, oh, thank goodness, now we have an actual candidate to represent us. He's going to end the wars, close Guantanamo. He's going to stand up to the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies and give us health care. And Obama didn't do any of that stuff. He certainly didn't crack down on Wall Street. So it's interesting to see that. And then, of course, by the same token, right-wingers, and again, not that I would endorse their views, but guys who like are really strong on defense and want to lock up criminals and want to cut welfare payments and let's really cut federal spending and let's cut taxes and have a flat tax and blah, 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 and all the right-wing stuff, even if they want to like close the borders and all that. And that's not what the Republican candidates ever actually do in practice. You know, let's get rid of the EPA and free up regulations on small business. The Republican candidates don't ever do that stuff. They say they're going to, but then they don't do it. So, but yet, the more you study politics and the way the political system works and voting and democracy, after a while, when you get to be in your 50s, you wouldn't say, gee, how come it is that the best candidates don't rise to the top? Like, how come the most pure, ideologically consistent, eloquent, smart, honorable, honest, progressive candidate doesn't get put up by the Democratic Party, and the same for the conservatives, for the Republicans, and then we have a legitimate election every 4 years with two definitely different worldviews and let the people choose? How come that doesn't happen? That doesn't make any sense. It seems like we always get two sides of the same coin and everybody's miserable and disgusted with politics. That doesn't make any sense to me. Well, when you see it over and over, like you start to understand why that happens, and it's just because that's the way the political process works, and that's the incentives in it, right? And so after a while, once you understand the way it works, you can see it would be shocking if good people did get on the tickets by the major parties to run for president. That there's no way you could spend your whole life in politics and, you know, be start local and then get to be a congressman, then get to be a senator, then get to be governor, and then you get to be the president, not necessarily hitting all those rungs, but you get what I'm saying. After you've been in politics your whole life and you're this completely honorable person who's never backstabbed anybody and you've never flip-flopped in your positions and da-da-da, that's almost impossible to even imagine that happening. Let alone would you be surprised that it didn't happen on a regular basis. So when you start thinking like that, and or just to take another example, war. Why do we still have war on planet Earth? It doesn't make any sense. Nobody benefits from the war because of very few people. The vast majority of people on both sides of a war are hurt by it. Just about everybody wants, if there is a war going on, just about everyone wants it to end, especially the people who are married to the people that are fighting, or especially the people who are getting bombed, right? So it's an odd sociological thing to just diagnose and say, you know, why, how can it be that people keep, you know, after generation, I mean, this isn't some new thing, right? And this is going way back. Throughout literature and all of our records that people have massive battles against each other. And why do they do that? That's crazy. It makes no sense, and yet it happens. And so I think people's support for states is related to that. Like if you could, you know, in other words, when you can understand, and the two go hand in hand, don't they? That to explain how it is that massive groups of people can be led into supporting the attempt to annihilate each other, even though they have no personal grudge against the average person on the other side of that imaginary line, but yet they can get all fired up and, you know, normal, humane people who walk their dogs and say hi to their neighbors in the park can cheer when our guys drop bombs on the babies of people who live across the ocean, you know, people that wouldn't hurt a fly domestically can get all fired up about blowing up babies across the ocean. Not that they're rooting for blowing up babies, but they're cheering the actions that, among other things, are blowing up babies. So that's it's an interesting thing. How can that be possible? And states are involved in that, aren't they? That really systematizes and institutionalizes and makes warfare much more possible on a grander scale than would ever be the case without having nation states in the modern sense. So, because that helps with the collectivism and it helps to get everyone rounded up and thinking, oh, it's us versus them. Whereas back when it was more like a feudal mentality and there were kings and so and barons and whatever, there were still wars, but like the common people didn't think, oh, it's us fighting them. They just thought, no, it's those noblemen fighting among each other. And we just want to not get hit in the crossfire. So the rise of the modern democratic nation state actually paved the way for total war. So back to your question, Gordon, about why do people keep choosing government? I mean, there is that. And it's not even just about political stuff, too. I mean, you could say, you know, if you're religious, the question could be, why do people keep sinning, even though you know it's wrong? And it's not just, if you're a religious person, the things that you think are sinful to do, it's not simply that oh, these are these fun things that I wish I could do, but, you know, my religious code arbitrarily forbids them. That no, you think for at least a lot of the stuff, it's in your long-run interest to refrain from that behavior, and it's protecting you. It's for your own benefit that you have these list of things that you're not supposed to do this stuff, and yet people do it. Or another example, I think most people would agree if they could just commit themselves to say, I am never going to lie, or I'm never going to be mean to somebody, that they would be a happier person. They wish they could commit to that, and yet in moments of weakness they lie or they're mean to somebody and then they regret it the next day and feel bad for a little bit. You see what I'm saying? So people do stuff that they know is wrong and yet they fall into it. And so I think it kind of, the support for government goes into that, that if you ask, you know, why is it that the average person supports the institution of government, if you sat down and explained to them, you know, don't you think it's odd that, like, let's say me, for example, I don't support, you know, in the United States, American, I don't think we should have troops over in the Middle East. And so if I'm talking to another American who's not an anarcho-capitalist and just, you know, regular guy, and I say, you know, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but I genuinely believe morally we should not be over there, and that offends my sensibilities, and I feel awful about that. Don't you think it's a weird system where I have to be forced to send a lot of my paychecks every month to support this cause that I am deeply offended by? And I think most people would say, yeah, that is bad, and that's a downside of our system, but I mean, Bob, we have to do that because otherwise we'll be vulnerable to an attack. You know, we have to have a national defense that's funded through taxation, because if we didn't have that, if it weren't mandatory, there'd be free riders who wouldn't chip in, you know, and we'd be vulnerable. So it's driven by fear. I think that's the real motivation, and as anyone who watches Star Wars and listens to the wisdom of Yoda knows, that fear comes from the dark side, and that leads to bad things, right? So I, you know, I'm sort of getting philosophical here, reflecting on the nature of the human condition, but I think that's ultimately, if you really wanted to know, why is it that we've had states and people don't embrace anarchy, I think it's because they're afraid and ignorant, and they think they need a state, and then with that mentality that most of the people have, there's always going to be power-hungry, ambitious people who will rise to the occasion and give the people what they can convince the people they need. So it's an interaction of all those things, I think. Gordon also says, we'd never consider starting over from scratch with any other field, medicine, agriculture, telecommunications, etc. Can you elaborate on that, Gordon? I think I know what you mean by that in relation to what we've been talking about, but can you just spell that out? And for those who have been trickling in here while we've been going, by all means, type in your questions. This doesn't have to be a conversation just between Gordon and me. Yeah, so Gordon says, we learn from one generation to the next, right? So the same. So with government, he's wondering, and again, this just circles back to what we've been talking about, you would think they would learn. And so I think part of it is once you go down that path, it's hard to reboot. So, for example, let me tweak your comment, Gordon, that in certain fields of human discipline, certain human disciplines, maybe it's not the case that there's this constant progression. Right? That's one of the things that Rothbard talked about a lot, referring to the so-called Whig view of history. In some areas, you're right. So I would say, and this is something that I stress a lot, the difference between the natural sciences and the social sciences. When I'm trying to explain Austrian economics to newcomers, that's one of the things that I hit early on, is this, when I'm trying to motivate Mises' views on the proper method for the social sciences, for economics in particular, and why he doesn't like the use of the natural science, the method of the natural sciences. And so one of the ways I motivate that discussion is I say, let's not worry about economics for a moment. Let's just step back and just look at human endeavors, disciplines, scientific types of disciplines, very few people would deny that there's constant improvement in physics and chemistry, in mathematics. Mathematics, we can leave that off to the side because it's not clear. Some people might not want to call that a science. But the so-called hard sciences, the natural sciences, most people think that there's this constant progression. And so you would rarely hear someone say something like, yeah, physics was awesome back in the day of Isaac Newton, but then that guy Einstein came along and screwed everything up, and he set physics down the wrong path, and it's taken a generation to recover from that cul-de-sac. Right? There are a few people that do talk like that, but most people think they're nut jobs. Right? That sounds like an odd thing to say to most people. Whereas if somebody gets up and says, psychology actually used to be great back in the late 1800s, and it was making a lot of improvement, whatever, and they were on the right track, and then Sigmund Freud came along, and he screwed up psychology and psychiatry and set them on the wrong path, and it's taken over a generation to recover from all that nonsense that Freud brought into it. A lot of people would say, yeah, you're right, or something that will be truer to us will ring true. If somebody said economics under the classical economists actually wasn't bad, then there was an improvement in the 1870s with subjective value theory. It was getting awesome. Under the Austrians in particular, it was great. And then Keynes came along and destroyed it. And then Paul Samuelson in particular took the Keynesian framework and approach and doubled down and made it all mathematical. And that has totally screwed up mainstream economics, and it has yet to recover from that crippling blow. Right? Plenty of Austrians talk like that, and that doesn't sound like an odd thing to say. So there are, in certain areas, it does seem like progress is not uniform or is not unidirectional, that it's possible to have regression. And so, and even in something like, even in medicine, you know, there's lots of people who think, like, once you start going down the path of treating people with all kinds of different drugs and things, and then all that introduces new side effects. And so what do? Oh, bring in another drug. Oh, my gosh, the kids can't pay attention in fifth grade. What do? Well, let's give them all kinds of Ritalin. Oh, wait, but that's leading to this. What do? Let's give them something else. And all these interventions, whereas some people think, no, that's the totally wrong approach, and you just keep tweaking little things here and there. You need to step back and realize your whole system is messed up. Or if you were, like, raised in a crime family and you were being groomed to be the godfather one day, your day-to-day decision, you know, you would think that every generation the kids should get better at being the godfather, being the don running the family. But yet, if being a crime syndicate boss is the wrong thing to do, they might not see, oh, maybe we should stop using violence to settle our problems. Maybe we should stop stealing from people. You see what I mean? So they would improve, but within their paradigm. Like, they would realize, oh, man, that was bad when we only had three guys guarding that one entrance because we just got hit by a drive-by shooter. We should really have six guys, but three of them need to be inside watching out the window where they can't get hit by bullets. And you see what I'm saying? Like, so they would improve things, but they'd be little tactical tweaks. They wouldn't be like a grand reassessment of the whole strategy. So I think it's the same thing with statecraft, if you will, that, you know, the founding fathers of the United States, for example, were very wise, and they were students of history, and they knew a lot about the nature of man and how politicians behave and so forth. And so in their mind, they created a system that was much more sensible, a vast improvement over the monarchies they had seen in their own lives. And some would argue that they did a good job, but obviously, if you're an anarcho-capitalist, you would think, no, they didn't take it far enough. They didn't really get at the heart of what the problem was. So I think that stuff is all involved. Just by its very nature, the state grows. And so unless you had completely rooted it out, it's not surprising that it just mushrooms over time. So it's because the state causes all kinds of social problems that the crafty politicians and other people who benefit from it Sorry, my phone's ringing there. We'll just let that go. Actually, hang on, let me just unplug it. So, you know, in other areas where there is constant improvement, the I guess the common element is the rules or incentives are such that when something's going wrong, that thing gets fixed and doesn't cause more problems and leads to an improvement. Whereas, like with the state, if they have minimum wage laws that cause unemployment, unfortunately, what usually happens is not that they say, oh my gosh, let's make things better and let's get rid of the minimum wage laws. No, then they say, well, we need job training. We need to have more funding for schools. So they raise taxes and take more money from people. And then now there's, you know, the people are poor. And they say, oh my gosh, everyone's poor. How come there's not job creation? Well, we obviously need to have a bigger stimulus package. And so they do that, you know, so it's just, they just keep multiplying the problems instead of undoing what was the original source. Okay. Again, everybody who's tuned in here, if you want to take us on a different track, by all means, chime in. So Gordon says, it was very enlightening to me to learn from Dr. Hoppe that democracy is not going to save us. Yeah, Hoppe's book, Democracy, The God That Failed, and of course some of his other writings that are in the same genre, was enlightening for me also. I mean, I knew before I had read his stuff, I was an anarcho-capitalist, and I knew that there was nothing magical about democracy per se, and that the very notion of democracy actually was kind of horrifying at its core. I mean, because what it means is mob rule. If you want to be crass about it or frank about it, that's what democracy means, that if more people want to do something than don't, well, then that's what happens. And so I would say to people things like regular Americans, you know, you wouldn't want a democratic election to determine who you had to marry or what mechanic was going to service your car engine or who was going to babysit your kids, right? That would horrify you if 51% of your neighbors could pick the person that was going to babysit your kids as opposed to you having the sole discretion in that choice. And so I was trying to carve out and show how everybody in their daily lives, there are plenty of decisions that they think they should have exclusive control over and should not be subject to democratic intervention. And so then, you know, if you can understand that, then I was saying, so why, if you own a restaurant, should 51% of your neighbors be able to tell you which people you can hire? You know, so how come you as a parent have absolute authority over who can babysit your kid, but you as an employer don't have absolute authority over who you can hire? And let alone authority over whether some of your money is going to go into making bombs to go kill people. You know, why can't you determine that? So I would use arguments like that, but what Hoppe brought to the table that I didn't realize fully was just the corroding aspect of democratic governments relative to more traditional monarchies and aristocracies. And he was saying, yes, those systems were bad and they were involved coercion and so on, but there was at least, like one of my favorite arguments that he puts there is he said, at least every once in a while, there might be a good king. You know, just luck of the draw, it was possible that somebody, you know, a given king would have a son who would get tutored in whatever, who might read certain literature or become under the influence of certain philosophers. And that kid might grow up to actually be a wise ruler who didn't plunge his people into war, who understood that lightly taxing the subjects would be better than heavy taxing, and blah, blah, blah. And so once in a while, you might actually get somebody good. It's true, if you had an awful king, then that was terrible because he had so much power and could plunge the country into war and whatever, but at least once in a while, luck of the draw, you might get a good king. Whereas under democracy, the way it works, you couldn't possibly get a truly wise person who had the sort of qualities that a good leader ought to have who would rise through the ranks and win election after election, then become leader of the nation. That's just, that couldn't happen. I mean, the winner of a Democratic election had to win a popularity contest. And in normal everyday conversation, when you refer to someone and say, oh yeah, he can win a popularity contest, that's not a compliment. That's, you know, we recognize usually that the actual true leaders, the people with true courage, might do unpopular things in the short run, but then after time looking back, people realize, oh yeah, that was the right thing to do. So, you know, and that's why we get these outcomes where, you know, it's amazing the kind of stuff that politicians have to say to their core constituencies in the primaries. And that's kind of what, like, Paul Krugman or whatever says about Mitt Romney. And that's not that I like Krugman in general, but I actually think he's right about that stuff, where Krugman says on his blog all the time, he'll quote stuff that Romney says on economics or whatever. And Krugman will say, you know, folks, don't worry. I don't think Romney actually believes this stuff. He's too smart to believe this stuff. He's just saying this to get his conservative base fired up. And then I would just, of course, say the same thing about the stuff Obama might say to some environmentalist supporters or some, or who knows what, that it's not even worthwhile asking, does Obama really believe that? Because that's a meaningless question. That they don't believe anything, or they don't care. They will do whatever they need to do in order to get elected. And then once in power, I don't think that those individuals actually have much of an agenda. I think that their agenda was, I want to be president. So yeah, Hoppe really did show a lot for there, and I think he did a lot to, in my mind, show that the problem with democracy. Well, one last thing, if there's other questions now that have accumulated, I'll turn to those. What Hoppe did for me was he showed, I guess I kind of thought I had bought the myth that, sure, democracy isn't the best system, and you can come up with all kinds of flaws for it, but at least it's a fair, more humane system or more just than monarchies or the aristocracies, because those are so unfair. And Hoppe was showing that, no, you could make a strong case that if you had to have a government of some sort, those other systems would be better. And one of the primary reasons, he said, is that it would tend to limit it. That if you did have an actual aristocracy or a monarchy, the people kind of understood that there was a separate apparatus there that was living off of them. Like, they might not have thought it was a parasite, but if it got too big, they would start to view it as a parasite. It was clearly, this is not of us. This is a separate system that is over and above us, ruling over us. And if you think they're doing a good job, you might be happy with that and respect them. But in no sense would you think that is us. Whereas with democracy, the reason democratic governments can get away with so much stuff is that the people are led to believe that the government, the state, is just an appendage of us. It just reflects the general will. And so almost by definition, the state can't do anything that harms the interests of the people, because the state is the people. If you live in a democratic society, that's what you're taught to believe. Whereas that myth is harder to get across if there's an actual feudal system or caste system or something where some people just know from birth there's no chance you're ever going to be the king. Whereas, what do we say in the United States? Only in America, where everybody could be president, right? That's kind of the myth that I'm trying to show, whoever gets to be the president is there because the people picked him or her to be the representative. Okay. Jeff Moore. Did you say you posted a question, Jeff? I don't see it. Could you retype it, Jeff, if you did post one? Because I don't see it. Okay, I'm going to keep answering Gordon. Jeff, like I said, I see that you said you posted a question, but I don't see it in here. So if you could just retype it and post it, then I'll answer it. Okay. Jeff says, can you provide further details as to why you are so confident that businesses would ostracize outlaws? I assume that your thinking is that businesses would do this as a means to compete with each other by appealing to lawful customers. My concern is that those lawful customers may be indifferent to that business policy if either A, they are mostly shielded from the behaviors of outlaws due to the nature of the industry, and then parentheses, what do I care if my energy provider provides energy to an outlaw? Or B, they're in no financial position to be picky about who they choose to do business with. If the lawful customers don't care, then the businesses wouldn't be likely to care either. Of course, this isn't much different than our current system. Are there other factors that I'm not considering? Okay, really good question. Okay, so let's break it down. And you're right. I sort of glided through that discussion without spelling things out carefully and the assumptions I was making. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. What we know for sure is that there would be incentives for some groups to shun or ostracize people who had been convicted of a crime and then were flouting the law, like they were ignoring the judgment. And so what we have in mind here, we're worried about what happens if we've got this cute private legal system that I talk about, where there's all these excellent, competent judges who aren't corrupt and so forth, and they really know this. There's this law code out there that they objectively apply to the various circumstances. So someone is a criminal. He does something. Let's say he engages in armed robbery, and he does that a few times, and it's a clear-cut case. He gets convicted. You know, the victims take him to various judges or whatever, and he just says, I'm not going to court. I don't care. I do whatever I want. And he's a real tough guy. He's got a bunch of guns and stuff, and nobody can stand up to him. All right, so he's convicted now. So it's well-known in the community. Like, there might be databases or whatever that maintain these records. Anybody who cares to know can quickly verify that this particular individual is a convicted armed robber and should be dealt with extremely carefully. So what I'm saying there is, if he had a job working at some factory, the owners of the factory are going to fire him and not let him come onto the property. And they're not doing that because they feel this moral obligation that, well, gee, we all have to have solidarity here and stand up for this guy. No, they're just doing it as a narrow act of self-interest, that you don't want a guy like that on your property because he might steal from you, he might hurt the other employees, he might be bad for morale, right? So you don't need to explain the motivation of the employer for firing the guy and not letting him come onto the property. If he is renting an apartment from somewhere, same thing. He would get evicted, they would change the locks, they would tell the doorman, don't let him in the building, blah, 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 because, again, obvious reasons, it's bad for your business if the other tenants are worried because they're sharing an elevator with an armed robber, right? So that kind of thing. Going into stores that have a lot of other customers, like a regular grocery store where moms are pushing their kids around in the carts or whatever, they will bar that guy. All right, so there's plenty of things that we just take for granted in everyday life. The other examples I were using were things like renting a car. Why would you rent a car to someone who's an armed robber? Chances are he'll give you the deposit and then not bring the car back. Right, so a lot of things like that, you wouldn't be able to get on a plane, all that kind of stuff. So now you're pushing it back to the next step. You're right. I did also say when I was trying to show, because remember, the context here is I was trying to show how far you could get and how much of a pain it would be if you did ignore legal rulings, even without introducing physical force, even without introducing the possibility that there are people out there who are employed privately, of course, by agencies, either directly by insurance companies or by other groups or whatever, whose job it is to go grab you and take you into custody. I was trying to say, do we even need to suppose that the free society would have such people that would be analogs of today's police officers? And so I was arguing that if we did have such a profession, it would be a lot smaller than it is today, because I think most lawbreakers would quickly succumb and just pay the fines or make plans to start making restitution or whatever, so they can get back in good standing with the community, just because the penalties would be so severe, even without invoking guys showing up who are going to take you in. So in addition to all the stuff that I just went through, Don, the next level of sort of sanctions, if you will, would be things like, what if you had your own piece of land somewhere and you went and you had a garden in your backyard? So, yeah, you can't go to the grocery store anymore, but you're not going to starve to death because you can grow your own food. And so then the question is, and this is what Jeff was getting at, how do I know, how can we be sure that the whole community would boycott that person? Because it's true, in the lectures I sort of was just flipping through that as if it would be automatic that the company that provides electricity to various places would turn that guy off, and that the Wi-Fi providers would turn that off. And presumably, if he tried to order a bunch of steaks online and have them get shipped to his house, that they would say, no, because you're a convicted armed robber, we don't ship steaks to you. Because otherwise, if he could do that, well, then the fact that he can't go to the grocery store isn't a big deal. He would just get the steaks and food shipped to his house. He'd pay more, but it's not he'd starve, right? So you're right. There is that element to it, and I should not have been so glib in just assuming all that stuff would kick in, because you're right. It's not necessarily the case that it would be in the narrow self-interest of people to completely boycott the guy. So, but keep in mind, even if we do just restrict it to people reacting purely in their own interest in light of this new information that the guy's a convicted criminal, a lot of doors would get shut, literally and figuratively, for this guy. So his life would change dramatically if he got convicted and then didn't do anything about it and just pretended like he was going to go about his daily life and, I don't answer the rules of anybody else. I do what I want. He's going to have a hard time getting through life with that mentality. So now I'm just like speaking off the cuff. There are, back when I was really debating this stuff a lot in grad school, various libertarians and anarchists and so on, we had all kinds of debates like this. And you could imagine complex interlocking agreements among people where they would recognize, if you had, and this was more when I was arguing about pacifism. So this wasn't so much when I was arguing anarchy per se, but I, as Walter from The Big Lebowski would say, I myself dabbled in pacifism. I was really, reading up a lot in pacifism stuff when I was in grad school, and I was arguing it intellectually with people trying to say, how far could we push this idea? Like, yeah, let's get rid of the state, but do we even need to have private police officers who use guns? What if they just had nets and foam sprays and, like, bulletproof shields and stuff? And then you push it even further and say, well, do you even need to have anything resembling police officers? What if everyone just would refuse to do business with violent people? And maybe that would be a better way to minimize violence overall. Maybe it's true, you would still get victimized occasionally by a bad person who saw, I'm not going to get tackled if I go around hurting people. So I'm going to. But maybe if you grew up in a world where 99.999% of the people were completely gentle, and if you went around and started punching people in the face, they would just take it and say, why are you doing that, my brother? Why are you hitting me? And that's all they did. You might stop punching people after a while. You might be like, I don't know why I'm doing that. I guess because I don't feel good about myself. Right? I don't know. I'm engaging in cycle battle, but you get what I'm saying. We were going through arguments like that, so we were trying to push it to say, how could you organize society along these lines, and how far could you push it? So one of the things we did start dabbling in, just intellectually, was to say, well, to really amp up the effectiveness of these boycotts, you could have a sort of interlocking hierarchical structure where somebody gets convicted of a crime. So you'd still have judges. Even if you had a society of complete pacifists, you could still have judges who would say, hey, that guy Jim Smith over there is a murderer. Watch out, everybody. You know, so you could still acknowledge that somebody was acting antisocially. It just means you wouldn't react to that using violence in any way. And so, you know, we were saying not only would there be a first wave of everyone in his own immediate interest boycotting the person in certain respects, but there might even be agreements that everyone, you know, joins this pledge up front. Like when you become an adult and you enter society, maybe just the custom is everybody officially signs on to this legally binding contract that says if anybody is ever accused of being a criminal rising to the level of such and such, like, you know, it would have to specify the severity of the crime, then these sanctions kick in. And, you know, and there could be varying things. Like, so maybe somebody who's convicted of theft but not of hurting anybody, maybe you're allowed to still sell food to the person through the mail. But maybe somebody who's convicted of being a serial killer, the things you agreed to in the society said, no, you're not even supposed to send food to this person. Like, we really have to cut this guy off. That's our only, because we want him to leave. We want him to move away from us and go, you know, into some other country somewhere. And the only way we're going to get him to do that, since we're all pacifists, is if we stop even giving him food. So you're not being compassionate by feeding the guy. You're having him stick around and continue to engage in serial killing, right? So, and then how would you police that? Well, you'd have to have a sanction saying it is illegal because you agreed to this contract. It is illegal if we catch you sending food to a serial killer. Like, you have just committed a crime because you agreed to it. Remember when you were 21 and you signed this part of this contract, it's just a social custom we have as a society of pacifists that part of what you do in our society is you sign this agreement that says, I promise if anyone on this, you know, list of reputable judges or whatever that gets updated every 6 months or something of who the judges have to be that have the power to so designate someone as a social pariah, right? Because you can't just have, if Jim Smith says, hey, that guy's a jerk, no one sell food to him, well, who's Jim Smith to make that call, right? So there had to be careful procedures before this ostracism hammer comes down on somebody, but supposing they had those procedures in place, then that's what would happen. There was actually a fascinating Twilight Zone episode that dealt with just this stuff. It wasn't like one of the old school black and white ones with Rod Serling. It was a newer one that was, I don't know, came in the 90s or something. And it was this like futuristic society, and they didn't have cops or anything. They just had these like floating balls that would go around. And if you got convicted of some sort of crime, I don't remember how they did it. Like, they would put a dot on your head, I don't remember. But there was some way that you would be marked, and just nobody would even talk to you, like, literally. Like, you had to pretend the person didn't exist, and that was your punishment in this world. They must have, like, given them food and stuff, because otherwise they would die. But, like, socially, you weren't allowed to interact with that person until their sentence was up. Like, so if they did something, you know, they might get that treatment for a month. If they did something worse, they might get that treatment for 6 months. So there was no prison. They didn't take you and put you in a cage. It was just everybody knew you can't talk to this person. And then it was a crime to talk to the person, right? And that was the premise of the episode, that somebody had compassion and broke down and, you know, was acknowledging the existence because this guy was going nuts. You know, somebody who had been convicted of a crime was saying, why would anyone talk to me? This is terrible. You know, because that's really, you know, it's like an isolation treatment, except you see everyone around you. So that was the premise, that it was psychologically even worse than being put. Because if you're put in solitary confinement, you go nuts. You know, there's studies and stuff saying to not be exposed to other humans actually drives you crazy. But at least if you're in solitary confinement, you can kind of understand what's happening and just realize, well, it's because there's these walls around me, and that's why I can't interact with people. But the premise of this Twilight Zone episode was it's far worse if you see others around you and they're all talking to each other and they're just ignoring you. Because then you know, it's like, no, there's something about me. It's not just I'm in this situation where I'm in a bunch of walls around me. It's that there's something horrible about me that everyone's willing to talk to each other but not to me. And it just drives you crazy. So anyway, the premise of this episode, or what happened, was some person who couldn't stand being so mean, broke down and talked to the guy, and then the orb saw him, and so then, you know, at the end of the episode now, he's marked, and he's going around saying, someone talked to me, and everyone's just pretending they don't see the guy. So it's kind of a cool thing to show. I think part of what the episode was trying to get across is that system might have actually been more tyrannical than locking people up in a cage. But then also the issue was it'd be hard to enforce that. It's a lot easier to grab someone and put them in a cage than to police the whole society and say, we can't trade with this guy, we can't talk to him. So anyway, I'm not really giving you a definitive answer, Jeff. I'm just trying to talk through some of the considerations and things like that. So yes, we've only got a couple minutes left here. In summary, you put your finger on an excellent point. In fact, I might even mention that in the next lecture, this issue of boycotting and interlocking boycotts and whatever. And this actually, for you guys who are paying attention to this stuff and aware of it, this issue of how do you enforce the boycott comes up a lot in sort of these movements that, if you remember, it had to do with Julian Assange, well, with WikiLeaks. It was when, this is like a year ago, if you guys remember this, when, I can't remember, it was like Amazon and PayPal and like these major financial clearinghouses they buckled under pressure from the U.S. government to not allow donations to go to WikiLeaks. I think I'm getting the details right. You know, people were giving donations to WikiLeaks because they supported what they were doing, and so the U.S. government leaned on the major companies that were involved in that were conduits for those donations, and said, we don't want that happening, and a lot of them caved and said, okay, well, you know, we don't want to upset the U.S. government, and so there were like antiwar.com was leading a big boycott of Amazon, I believe. I hope I'm not getting the details mixed up because this happened like a year ago. But I'm pretty sure, you know, and so then the libertarians were divided on this issue. And then the issue, and some didn't boycott Amazon. Some were saying, Amazon's not the bad guy here. It's the U.S. government's the bad guy. You know, so why would we boycott Amazon? You know, we all pay our taxes too, right? That's ultimately funding the war on terror and all the stuff that WikiLeaks is trying to expose, so it's kind of hypocritical for us to keep paying our taxes to the U.S. government so it can make bombs to blow people up, and yet we're going to punish Amazon because they were afraid to stand up to the U.S. government. Why do we pay our taxes if we don't support the war? Because, well, we're afraid we'll go to jail. So it's like we're afraid of the government too, and we do stuff that supports the war effort out of fear, and that's exactly what Amazon did. They were afraid if they stood up to the government, then their business would get ruined. And so, you know, so the argument for the people who weren't boycotting Amazon was that. And so then the issue was for the boycotters, are we going to take action against people who aren't boycotting Amazon with us? So not only did they have to decide, are we boycotting Amazon, but they also had to decide, are we going to sort of have a dispute now with the other anti-war people who don't agree with us? Because obviously this boycott of Amazon is only effective if we get thousands of people to sign on. If just a few of us huff and puff and walk away, what does Amazon care? We need this massive grassroots campaign to withhold purchases from Amazon until they allow whatever donations to WikiLeaks or whatever. By the way, I might be fumbling with the details, but the spirit of what I'm saying is correct. So that's I remember that, and that was an interesting issue. So you do have these things with economic ostracism. It can be very effective, but so the benefits of it are that it's completely voluntary, right? That it's, there's no doubt you have the right, in terms of libertarian property rights theory, there's no doubt you have the right to refrain from economic transactions with somebody. And in particular, somebody that you think is a criminal, of course you have the right to not sell stuff to that guy or to not buy things from him. Of course you have that right. So we're sure we're not aggressing against somebody by using economic sanctions in the sense of a libertarian, not in the sense that we surround the guy's house and point guns at other people and say, we're not letting you trade with him. I should say boycott, sanction is a loaded term. All right, so we know boycotts are perfectly within our rights to do, so we're not violating, we're not aggressing against someone by having a boycott. But then the downside is, to be effective, lots and lots of people have to participate in the boycott. You can't just have five people boycott somebody. That's not really going to hurt them. And so then the issue is, do you have to move it up a level and punish people who don't do the boycott? And then you can even bump it up a higher level and say, do you punish people because you catch them trading with someone who wasn't respecting the boycott? See what I'm saying? So it's not merely do we have to decide, is it, do you become part of the boycott campaign if we catch you trading with the convicted killer? But it's also, what if I see my neighbor selling food to a guy who I know is selling electricity to the serial killer? Now, am I obligated to not deal with the other guy who's like two steps removed? You see what I'm saying? And then it's just this big chain of how that works. So what's kind of interesting is, if you get into game theory, you know, there are models like this. There are strategic situations that have this flavor where it's like a prisoner's dilemma, if you're familiar with those things. But in a repeated game where they keep doing a prisoner's dilemma over and over. And so the thing is, in any one iteration, if people do the narrowly self-interested thing, it leads to an outcome that actually isn't good for anybody. And so they would all be better off, in a sense that they could all force each other to do something that's not in their immediate self-interest. Then they'd be better off in the long run. And so you can build up in these sort of finitely repeated prisoner dilemma situations complex strategies that involve multiple layers of punishment, and then, but you know, saying, if you've got a group of 10 people in this game and one person defects and does what's in his immediate interest that kind of screws the group over, the next round everybody else has to punish him. Like, that's what their strategy has to be, that if you screw us in round one, then in round two we're going to hit you, even though it's costly to us. And then the rationale for that is, then, given that those are the strategies, in round one nobody does the selfish thing because he knows I'm going to get hit in round two. But the question is, how do you make that a credible threat? Because what happens if in round two everyone's being called upon to punish you in a way that's costly to them? Well, why would they do that? See what I'm saying? So in order to make what's called sub-game perfect equilibrium, where everything is where all the threats are credible, where you're not being called upon to do something that the criminal thinks you're not going to do that because you'd be hurting yourself to do that too. There's these complex things where if you don't punish, you know, so if some guy defects in round one, your strategy calls for you to punish him in round two, but what if you didn't? Well, then in round three, everybody punishes you. So that's why it's even in your immediate interest, your narrow interest, to punish a guy in round two who defected in round one, because you're doing it to avoid getting punished in round three. See? And then, well, why would they do that to you in round three? Because if they didn't, then they would get hit in round four. And you can build up these things, and it's kind of, you know, that my game theory professor at NYU, that's what his dissertation was, on these kinds of strategies, and he was just showing how you can build up these things, and it's all, you know, the math all checks out, and so you can get cooperation in a finitely repeated prisoner's dilemma, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, you can, these things are kind of cool to think through, and then just to think about in the real world, could this work, and so forth, where you had multiple rounds of punishment, whatever, just using ostracism. Okay, well, we're over time. Why don't we stop there? Thanks, guys, for tuning in, and like I said, Jeff, that was a, I'm glad you brought that up, and if there's time, I may even just briefly address that in next week's lecture, because you're right, I was mixing things up there and making it sound like it would automatically be the case that everybody would boycott a serial killer. When why wouldn't you keep setting him stakes if he was sending you gold coins in the mail? All right. See you later, guys.